Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, pals. Before we get into the episode this week, I just wanted to remind you that I'm going to be in Cork on Thursday night at the Everyman. That is at 8 o'clock on Thursday, the 1st of February, which is St. Bridget's Day. So what we're going to do is we're going to talk about women, guys. One of my favorite topics. Going to be celebrating women. And my guest is Alva Smith, who is an icon. If you don't already know who she is, you will love getting to know her. She is a woman who has been involved in every bit of progress we've made as women, in my opinion, in Ireland over the last 50 years, 60 years. She is an Irish academic. She's a feminist. She's an LGBTQ activist. You may recognize her from the marriage equality campaign. You may recognize her from the repeal campaign. She is incredible. And aside from all of that, she is such a lovely and warm woman. I know you will love hearing from her in the Everyman on Thursday. Aside from that, we are going to have music from the brilliant Chubby Cat, who I got to see for the first time at Other Voices, and she just absolutely blew me away. So it's going to be a night to remember. Get your gals together. You can go for a little dinner beforehand. I promise you, I will give you loads to think about and talk about. Come and join me in the Everyman on Thursday. Hello, my friends, and welcome to Catch Up with Louise McSharry. This is the podcast where I do my best to catch you up on the week, along with my team of crack contributors. If you haven't been paying attention, no problem. And frankly, it's understandable if you haven't been paying attention. There's been a lot going on, and we all have busy lives. But don't worry, over the course of this, let's be honest, hour and a half, I don't know how it happened that every week now the episodes are like an hour and a half long. It's a lot. And I apologize for it, frankly, because it's too much. But we are where we are. I'm working on it. I have some ideas. We'll see how things come to fruition over the next few weeks. But thank you so much for tuning in. I love you. You are my fave. I had a pretty good week, actually. I got to go to the All of Us Strangers Irish premiere gala screening on Friday night, which was so exciting. And when I got the email inviting me to go, I've never replied to an email so fast in my entire life. I was so excited, especially because it said specifically members of the cast and crew will be in attendance. Now, there's only four people in that film, guys. So, and I was like, it would be very strange if it was Jamie Bell and Claire Foy who came rather than the two Irish men who were in the film. So I had a feeling it was going to be Andrew Scott and Paul Mescal. And it was. And it was just lovely to see them introduce the film with Andrew Haig, who wrote and directed it. I'm such a fan of all three of them. And there was a really, really gorgeous moment. If you've watched my Instagram stories, you may have heard me say this already. But before the screening, Andrew Scott became quite overwhelmed with emotion at bringing this movie to Dublin, and at the reception that they were getting. There were so many people there and everyone was just so enthusiastic about this film. And he was just saying, you know, it's such a stark contrast to when he was a teenager and you just couldn't walk down the streets holding hands if you were gay. And he was, yeah, he was like fully crying. It was really, really beautiful. And then the film itself, I loved. It is, I know everybody's saying it, but like, I mean, you will cry. You may cry a lot. There's many layers to it. There's the love story. There's loss. There's lots of kind of parenting stuff in there. So if you're a parent, I'd say you'll have feelings. If you have your own trauma with your own parents, you'll probably have feelings. If you're gay and you did not get the reaction that you wanted from your parents when you came out, There's so many different facets to it. I loved it. I loved it so much. I'm going to go see it again. I'm going to see it actually on Sunday again. Yeah, I can't recommend it enough. It's brilliant. Other than that, the week was good. I did all kinds of fun things. I have been reading a lot. I've been going to the cinema a lot. Tonight, I'm doing the Q&A after two screenings of the film Your Fat Friend, which I absolutely love and is on in the IFI. And it's going to be coming for a more general release soon. So if you haven't been able to make it to any of the screenings so far, don't worry. But yeah, very much looking forward to hanging out with Aubrey Gordon and Jeannie Finlay tonight. Jeannie Finlay, who made the film about Aubrey Gordon, who I've had on this podcast. If you listen regularly, you know, you may know her from her own podcast, Maintenance Phase, and her brilliant writing as well. She has several books. She is iconic, frankly. So yeah, a good book for Louise, professionally for the most part. I posted about this on Instagram as well, so you may see me talking about it. But commercially, this has been a tricky time because we are all being forced to make some difficult calls in terms of who we work with and what we do in relation to Israel and Palestine and some of the boycotting that's happening at the moment. It's not black and white. It's complicated. I've gotten messages all morning from people asking me where to find the boycott list. And the problem is that there are lots of different ones. The BDS movement is the main one to look up. But even within the BDS movement, you know, the boycott lists are tiered. There are businesses at the top of the list who are directly funding the Israeli military. And obviously, I could never in good conscience work with someone who was doing that currently. But then further down the list, it's people with much looser ties to Israel and, you know, people who are not connected to the military at all. And, you know, everyone has to make their own decisions about who they work with and who they don't work with. It is complicated and tricky. But I would encourage you to have a look and make your own decision based on your own circumstances. That's all we can all do. But yeah, I've had to turn down a couple of campaigns lately, because of, you know, for these very reasons. So I would say, if you're someone who has ever considered joining the Patreon, now would be a really good time to do that. The Patreon is the best way to support the podcast, to support my work, to help me pay my contributors, and also to ensure that I can continue to do this. I also put some extra episodes on there. As you probably know, if you listen regularly, there's a mailbag episode every month, which is probably my favorite, where I listen to your responses via voice note and respond. We talk about all kinds of things over there. There's a lovely community. And then also there's a culture episode, which is me discussing some cultural facet. Sometimes culture feels like a bit too highbrow. Like it might be a documentary, it could be a book, it's mainly documentaries actually, as it turns out, as it's kind of happened, but it's you know, very loose. We could be talking about anything. We talked about Madonna at one stage. It could be any facet of culture. And there's going to be a new one of those episodes going up this week. We're going to be talking about American Nightmare, which is a documentary on Netflix, or documentary. Oh my God, I can't even say documentary. What is wrong with me? It's a documentary on Netflix, Jesus, which I'm going to be discussing for a new episode. And I haven't seen it yet. I haven't watched it yet. So please don't take the lightness of my tone to indicate that I suggest that the content is light, because from what I hear, it's not. I simply can't speak today, which is, I'm not going to lie, a challenge when you're trying to do a podcast. With that in mind, let's carry on and get the news with the journal.ie's Carl Kinsella. Carl Kinsella, how are you?
I am not too bad, Louise.
How are things in Amsterdam?
Good. Surviving.
Surviving, yeah.
Been a stormy week here, like it's been in Ireland. But yeah, I got some good grades in my master's this week.
Oh, so. Congratulations. Are you gonna solve everything?
There's just no thrill like good grades. I don't know why. I just have nerd DNA, but there's just nothing like getting a good grade.
And what are you doing? Like, is it like essays and stuff?
Yeah, and it's essays and also kind of investigations. Like, I'm doing a lot of open source intelligence kind of exercises. So I did an investigation of like flooding in the Seychelles. It was very exciting.
You were in the right place doing the right thing, if you have those feelings. And I am happy for you.
Thank you.
Okay, well, let's get into the news, because there is, as always, lots of it. And, you know, I was talking to someone yesterday about the podcast, and they were like, it's just that the news is so grim. And I was like, yeah, it is. I mean, I don't know what to tell you. It is grim. And unfortunately, it is grim this week. However, there are some interesting developments in terms of our position with Gaza, aren't there?
Yeah, quite interesting. So last night the Sock Dems put forward a motion for Ireland to back South Africa's application against Israel in the International Court of Justice, which we've talked about for the last couple of weeks.
Yeah.
And that motion was defeated, but there was a counter motion from the government which did pass. And it's the wording of it is really weird. I think it's the kind of thing that people will look at and they'll be like, what does this even mean? And it's the wording of the motion that passed was that Ireland would, quote unquote, strongly consider intervening in the case taken by South Africa. And I think it's weird for people when they learn that the government is passing a motion to just strongly consider something, you know, like what could that possibly mean? In this case, it does mean that. So the ICJ will be releasing their preliminary verdict today. That's going to happen at around midday or 1 p.m. Ireland time. So by the time podcast listeners hear this, we'll know more about that. But if there is a finding made by the ICJ that Israel are guilty or preliminarily guilty and they're ordered to cease fire and ordered to let UN aid into Israel. And just to be clear, go back to what we said last week, even if that is ordered, really very little way to enforce it.
Yeah.
But if that is ordered, then it is possible now that Ireland would intervene and back South Africa's application. So that's what strongly consider means in this case.
Do you think in relation to the you know, there's no way to enforce that, would that have an impact on America's position, do you think? Like, would America find it hard to continue to support what's going on, or harder if there was that ICJ ruling?
I think, you know, that's sort of like a consideration in terms of like probably PR and in terms of America's standing with other allies. You know, if say countries like Ireland, say you could have countries like France, you know, other countries might roll in behind South Africa now. You could have Belgium, you could have these other countries that have been kind of supportive at different times of the Palestinian cause. I don't think you'd see too much movement from America, to be honest. Like, they've already, I think Anthony Blinken's quote on the ICJ application was that it was completely meritless. So I think even if it were to be found by the ICJ that Israel has some level of culpability here, I think you'd be, it would be a miracle if the US were to start taking it seriously now.
God, it's wild, isn't it? Because it really does feel like we're not going to get anywhere unless America changes its position, because, you know, they are literally making it possible for this invasion to continue. And, you know, it seems to be, I just can't get my head around it, because every week I'm seeing more and more people in America saying that they can't possibly vote for Joe Biden in good conscience as a result of their position on Israel. And, you know, an election is coming, and yet they're so committed. It's crazy to see. Like, I feel like never before has the relationship between money and oil and politics and all of that stuff been so black and white for us normal people to see.
Yeah, and it's, you know, it leaves kind of ordinary people completely at odds with the sort of political direction of their countries. Because, you know, I think even from the most cynical point of view, we always think that politicians will do what's politically expedient.
Yeah.
But even watching this situation, you know, Joe Biden is not polling well. He's not popular right now. People really disapprove not only of him, but how he's handling the Gaza situation. And yet there is no signaling that there's going to be a U-turn or there's going to be any, you know, movement. So it's just it's like you say, it's sort of the money and it's the oil and the power, and it's really, it's eye-opening. And I mean, I suppose probably people who lived through the Iraq war, not that I really did, I was, you know, a child, but
can you stop reminding us of that, please, Carl? It feels personal at this point.
I like how that could apply either to my youth or the Iraq war. Like, Carl, stop bringing up the Iraq war, man.
I was talking about your youth, to be clear.
But yeah, it gives people a similar feeling of this, just this war that the public has no investment in. And I think, you know, people, you know, and you do see it, and we've talked about this week after week. Each week it does seem like there's more pressure for it to stop and more people from different areas. Like, I think more and more celebrities are calling for it to stop.
Yeah.
there was like a lot of Succession actors this week had a lot to say about it, and I think Mandy Patinkin as well.
Ben Affleck, so
you have that pressure constantly building, but yeah, I mean, it still hasn't gone anywhere. But yeah, it'll be very interesting to see now what kind of verdict the ICJ does render, because I think that will lead to a lot of new whether it's a you know, preliminarily guilty or preliminarily not guilty. You know, it'll lead to some very interesting new conversations.
Yeah, a couple of other notable things that happened this week in terms of what's going on in Gaza. There was a clip on ITV News of a Palestinian man who was waving a white flag, and he was subsequently shot by an Israeli sniper or an IDF sniper. And, you know, that's gone absolutely viral and pretty shocking to see, but not really surprising, is it, to people who've been following this conflict?
No, I think, yeah, if you've been following the conflict, I don't think there's anything that could surprise you at this point. But there's, yeah, there's something about the kind of narrative of it. Like, this was a man, an older man. He was trying to appeal for, you know, a bit of calm where he was. He said he had his mother and his brother in the house nearby. And there were, I don't know, like, he was waving a white flag, so he was obviously like appealing for peace as the international sign of truce. He's being interviewed by ITV, and moments later, after the interview was concluded, while the cameras were still running, he was clearly shot on camera, and he was killed. Which is just, it's you know, what do you say?
No, there's
to that,
no words, you know, for it. There are no words for it. It's and it is just another demonstration of, I feel like, the kind of attitude and motivation of the IDF. I mean, we keep seeing this, that like it seems to be almost indiscriminate in terms of who they, you know, target and where the violence goes, and this, and so why so many civilians have been killed in this invasion.
Go ahead. Well, I was just going to say, it kind of harkens back to what we were saying earlier as well, that like ITV are being so emphatic about the facts here. You know, they're, and this is, you know, we talk about pressure building on Israel, you know, a kind of a very establishment oriented institution like ITV, you wouldn't necessarily think would be leaning this way or that, but like it just becomes undeniable. You know, yeah, if you have people working for you on the ground and they're capturing this footage, you know, and you're a journalist or a journalistic organization, you need to push the truth on this. And that's kind of what ITV are doing. They're being quite, because the IDF are trying to, you know, they've said that the footage was edited. They've said this and they said that, you know, there's often just they're kind of typical obfuscation tactics. But yeah, ITV have been very kind of forthright on it, and it's you know, ultimately all it really is it's just a very disturbing video, another very disturbing example of violence in Gaza. So
yeah, on the 27th of October, the Israeli army said that they had their deadliest day of ground war, where they lost 21 soldiers in Gaza. And there was a lot of conversation about the reporting of this, because some headlines said things like 21 Israeli soldiers killed in deadliest day of ground war, and people were like, hang on a second, that's not the deadliest day. It's the deadliest day for Israel, but obviously thousands of Palestinians have been killed, so it doesn't apply. But, you know, we haven't really heard big reports of Israeli soldiers being killed, have we?
No, we haven't. And like, that's, I mean, and this kind of gets at the heart of it, you know, like Hamas are not a hugely capable organization. They don't have, you know, access to the kind of weapons that can do the kind of damage that the Israel army does, you know, not even a little bit, not even occasionally. So, you know, we're 3 months in, 4 months in, and this is, you know, 21 soldiers. That's the highest death toll in a day for Israel's military. I do think the interesting thing about this was the way it was reported. I know RTE had to delete a tweet in which they called it the highest death toll for a day in the conflict, which is just, you know, and you would be inclined maybe to forgive it, but there were just so many examples of so many different organizations reporting it that way, which it just, you know, it makes you just scratch your head and wonder why, you know, what is the editorial direction being kind of handed down at these places? Because the suggestion there really is that the Palestinian lives don't count.
Matter, yeah.
But that is the suggestion. You know, if this is the only thing, if you don't consider it a death toll when hundreds of Palestinians are killed in a day, which is happening every day, I really just don't know what your perspective on the conflict could possibly be.
Yeah.
So I think, yeah, that really, that certainly would have been eye-opening for people and you know, additionally concerning.
Finally, in terms of Gaza, lots of people will have been following what was happening there via Motaz Azeza, who, as most people know him, who has been reporting via social media and other platforms since the beginning. And, you know, I think a lot of people feel really heavily emotionally invested in him and his well-being. And this week he evacuated and there was a lot of emotion around it.
Absolutely, because I think that Motaz, as I say, he will come out of this conflict as a sort of, you know, an icon, almost a historical figure.
Definitely.
24 years old, you know, essentially cataloging and documenting this entire conflict through his smartphone. It really is, it's inspiring and it's incredible and it is tragic. You know, it's tragic more than it is anything else. Mm. And he has evacuated this, I think, to Qatar. Mm. And he... You know, he will be safe, which is, you know, that's very comforting, because there's been so many throughout the last couple of weeks and months. You'll see Motaz tweet that, you know, there are drones outside where he's staying or a helicopter circling overhead. And you get the sense that he is in very real danger. And of course, we've seen, you know, dozens of journalists. So it's been the most dangerous conflict for journalists in possibly ever. Mm. So it's, you know, it's the kind of thing people will take comfort now that he's safe. But it also gets to the point that a lot of people do bring up, that we're going to know less about what's happening in Palestine as a result of this. And that's already happened, because so many journalists and so much journalistic infrastructure has already been destroyed. Mm. Motaz was maybe one of the number one source of what was happening over there. So we need to be prepared now to be even further in the dark.
Mm. It's complicated, because obviously people are relieved that he's going to be safe, but there's also such a heartbreaking sadness in him being forced to leave his home and his country. And that is the reality of what's happening, is that Palestinian people every single day are either being killed or driven out of their homes and their home country. I mean, out of their homes a long time, but out of their homeland. And it is heartbreaking. Okay, let's move on. Let's talk about this Russian... So there was a plane crash in which 65 Ukrainian prisoners of war were on board, and many of them died.
Yeah, and this is in Russia. This is going to be a really hard case for anyone outside of Russia and Ukraine to get to the bottom of. You have Kiev claiming one thing and Moscow claiming another, and Moscow claiming that, you know, Ukraine shot down the plane themselves. You know, as part of an act of war, that I think is probably not going to pass muster with people who are skeptical of Russia. Russia obviously have history of shooting down planes in a way that, you know, very recently Yevgeny Prigozhin, the Wagner group leader who tried to organize a coup against Vladimir Putin, he was killed in what was supposedly an accidental plane crash, you know, just weeks after challenging the authority of Putin. You had in 2014, the commercial jet that was flying from Netherlands to Malaysia, which was shot down over Donetsk by Russian paramilitaries. So it is a Russian tactic, you know, is to shoot down planes. And I mean, even as we see in the case of Yevgeny Prigozhin, even its own planes. Mm. So we're talking about the fatalities here are 65 Ukrainian prisoners of war. The fatalities are Ukrainian. Mm. So it's you know, it's not the kind of thing I can really speculate on. You know, I can't point my finger and say this is what I think happened, but I think it's the kind of thing that people will look at with a great degree of skepticism.
Yeah, and I think it's important to flag that you know, that conflict is not over. You know, obviously we have another one to look at, but we can't forget that is still ongoing. Okay, let's talk about the storms, because the weather was crazy here this week. I think we can all agree. And Carl, you were saying it's stormy in Amsterdam as well. But it did, unfortunately, have a very real impact on lots of people's homes and businesses and lives in general, didn't it?
Yeah,
or didn't sadly, they? Because it was two storms.
It was two storms. It was Isha and Jocelyn, which are two good names.
They are, I agree.
But some tragic, we had, you know, road accidents and I think there were three people killed on the island of Ireland, between the North and the Republic, which is really sad. And it's an interesting thing has happened recently. You've probably seen it, where you get a lot of people now complaining about level red warnings, level orange warnings. Mm. People are, you know, it's almost like that 15-minute city conspiracy where people think Met Aaron are trying to like keep them indoors.
Yeah.
And it's an area where like misinformation has actually been allowed to thrive, and it's kind of crazy. And you see in weeks like this, you know, storms are no joke. You know, like red level warnings are no joke. You know, people can get badly hurt, and businesses can be destroyed, and homes can be damaged, and unfortunately people can lose their lives. So yeah, it is actually important to, you know, when you see these status red warnings, it is actually important to, you know, I know it's the cliche, but to avoid the unnecessary journeys and etc. But yeah, you had hundreds of thousands of businesses without power, you know, trees coming down. It's not fun. And you know, obviously for a lot of people, you can kind of snuggle up warm inside, and it's okay, and you can kind of watch the storm from behind your window. But you know, there are tragic, and we also had I actually haven't researched this is my question for you, because I'm mostly outside of Ireland. The flight that was redirected from Manchester to Paris that was supposed to go to Dublin, I assume that was because of the storm, right?
Yeah, there were loads of flight cancellations, and then there were loads of flights who really struggled to land. Flights who were redirected to Belfast couldn't land in Belfast. People who were on flights that were supposed to be 35 minutes long that were 5.5 hours long. I saw lots of people with very good attitude about it, I have to say. You know, people who were saying that like they'd almost become a community on board the plane, that they were there for many, many hours rather than half an hour. But yeah, it seemed like it was a very unfortunate time to be traveling. I've been in situations like that where you've gotten on a plane and then you've had to get off and you've had to go to a hotel or so. I saw people sleeping in airports. Yeah, it was tricky. So thoughts are with you if you had to travel this week, but you know, I suppose airlines have to make sure that people are safe at the end of the day, as previously discussed via the Boeing incident. Okay, now this is very complicated. I appreciate that this is complicated, but let's try very simply to explain what is going on with Stormont in Northern Ireland.
This is going to be hard. let's do our best.
Well, here, let's just do top lines. We don't have to get too in the weeds.
This is, I'm a man who studied political science and also has been a journalist for like 8 years, and even still, the machinations of what happens in Stormont in Northern Ireland is just so hard to wrap your head around. But okay, right now what's happening is that the deadline for sort of the DUP and Sinn Féin, and also the other parties in Northern Ireland, the deadline for them coming to an agreement to restore power sharing in Stormont has been kicked down the road to February 8th. So currently, Stormont is suspended. There's no assembly in Northern Ireland governing anything. Most of the governing is being done by, you know, senior civil servants, and that's kind of being directed from London. Now, the reason that Stormont is suspended is because the DUP have an issue with, I mean, a lot of people would tell you that it's sort of almost like a false pretense. You know, like the DUP are famously obstinate. I think a lot of people will tell you that their fear is that they are losing a lot of ground to Sinn Féin. The demographics in the north are changing. Sinn Féin is constantly becoming more popular. You know, before long, the DUP are going to lose more ground. Sinn Féin are going to continue to become a bigger party. I mean, if things kind of follow the trajectory they have been. And all of this kind of incentivizes the DUP to sort of activate its veto and refuse to engage with, you know, the governance of Northern Ireland, essentially.
Mm.
Now, when Stormont is suspended, under the Good Friday Agreement, the UK does have an obligation to call another election.
Right.
But what the UK is trying to do is just keep kicking the can down the road. So, like, you know, we've been suspended now for years. I think it could be since 2021. And they were suspended for a long time before that in 2017 over the Cash for Ash scandal.
Mm.
But this time, yeah, so we've got Chris Heaton Harris is his name. He's the MP with responsibility for Northern Ireland. He's the Secretary of State for Northern Ireland. And he has announced, you know, a new deadline of February 8th. But, you know, this is the kind of, I think the reason people are frustrated by this is because there has been no progress. There's no suggestion that Sinn Féin and the DUP, and this is not an advocation of Sinn Féin, but I mean, I'm comfortable in saying that the DUP are the bigger obstacle here. You know, the DUP don't, you know, I don't get any sense that they want to return to governance. It seems to be more of a, you know, just presenting themselves as an obstacle to governance. But
and I think people are frustrated because they're still being paid. Like, you know, these people
they're still being paid.
You know, and yet they haven't been doing the job for months and months and months and months.
Yeah, and for me, I think what frustrates me always is not even just the pay, but the fact that they refuse to govern, but they still kind of speak on behalf of Northern Ireland. So you'll get the DUP making these big statements about what the people of Northern Ireland want, when in actual fact, you know, they're in a position where they're refusing to sort of go into coalition and work together with Sinn Féin to get anything done. You know, Michelle O'Neill this week said people have had enough of the DUP's inaction. And I think, you know, that kind of sums it up. And again, not to sort of take a side.
Yeah.
But I mean, this one is it's very hard to look at it and come to any other conclusion than the DUP is just sort of doing its best to stay in the way of a government being formed. Which is just, that's not right for the people of Northern Ireland. Like, people of Northern Ireland don't want to be governed by senior civil servants and
well, that's like not what they voted for. You know, like, that's not democracy.
No, exactly.
Yeah, it's crazy. Yeah. Okay, quickly before I let you go, there was an awful report this week about the Oliver Bond flats in Dublin, where basically it seems like the situation is almost unlivable.
Yes, this is a colleague of mine, Eimear McCauley at the Journal. It's a really interesting report by her, but it makes for kind of almost stomach turning reading if you read the accounts of the people living in the Oliver Bond flats. You know, it's like some crazy stats. You know, like there was a study published. So the study is kind of about the health of the people in the Oliver Bond flats, and found that they're twice as likely as the average person to have asthma. You know, like that's
crazy.
That's crazy. You know, in 2024, you got 83% living with mold and damp, 55% told by a medical practitioner that damp, mold, or sewage is contributing to their ill health in their families.
It's what it is. It's disgusting. Like, this is the kind of stuff that pisses me off so much, because we have a government in a housing crisis who claim that they're doing what they can and that they're making progress. And yet we're years and years and years into this housing crisis. People can't get homes in the first place. The least they could do as they're putting money into a rainy day fund is make sure that the homes that they are able to provide are livable and that aren't making people sick. Like, this is crazy.
Yeah, and it's like another quote, like people get these crazy ideas about like social housing and stuff. Like, one of the people who Eimear spoke to, they're paying €650 in rent. That's huge rent. You know, like that's twice what you would have paid for a room, you know, 15 years ago.
Yeah.
And I'm talking about like a nice room in Dublin. You know, there's twice that.
Yeah.
So it's just, I don't know, like people... I think anyone who reads this report would surely come away from it thinking that, you know, Ireland is in a really dire situation. And it's upsetting. It really is upsetting.
And one of the main reasons that we know about it is because there is a handful of residents who have decided that they're going to speak out. But one of them, Natasha, who is quoted in the piece that you referred to, said that most people are too embarrassed to say. She said they don't want people thinking they aren't clean or that they won't put money into the flats themselves. A lot of us have put money in and then it's no use because the damp keeps coming back. And this is the problem with classism and social stigma, is that if you feel like there's already an attitude about you that people who live in council housing aren't clean or don't take care of themselves or don't take care of their flats or whatever, then it would be incredibly hard to say my flat is in bits, even though it's not your fault. Like, it's awful.
It's dehumanizing it, and it's just like, I can only hope that, you know, the fact that this is being reported now will direct some much needed attention towards it, and hopefully a solution can be found, because it's not right that in 2024, you know, people are living as if it's 1924, you know, and as you say, it's...
Well, exactly. We're not in the tenements now. We shouldn't be. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then finally, before I let you go, I just wanted to acknowledge that Ian Bailey died, a name like has to be one of the most known names in Ireland, because of his connection to the Sophie Toscan de Plantier murder in 1996. He was the chief suspect. Obviously, there's been very complex court cases over many years in relation to it. But he died of a heart attack.
Yeah, I think that was kind of oddly unexpected. I think, you know, as you say, Ireland has such an odd relationship with this man.
Really odd.
he is, you know, kind of almost like a, I don't really know how to say it, but like almost like a pop culture figure, you know, yeah. because he's been at the center of so many documentaries and podcasts. And
it's uncomfortable, to be honest. Like, it's an uncomfortable relationship. I think most of us would agree.
I think it is. It's kind of our, it's like our big true crime, you know, it's our big true crime story. I think, you know, what people probably, I'd say that podcast West Cork has probably got a lot of international listenership. I think it's just our, it strikes me as our most famous sort of true crime story or historical unsolved crime.
And it
is interesting. Like Ian Bailey, he was never charged with anything in Ireland. He was, you know, for anyone who doesn't know the story, he was a local reporter at the time that Sophie Toscan du Plantier died. He was reporting on it. Like he was on the ground immediately with the story. And it emerged that he was the suspect, whether that was because he kind of confessed to people locally or just various other suspicions people had about him. But a very strange man. And because Sophie Toscan du Plantier was French, the French were able to level charges against Ian Bailey, which is a really weird system. Like, that's not a common thing for a country to sort of exercise jurisdiction outside of its own borders. They convicted him in absentia. So, like, you know, as far as, you know, the French state is concerned, he's a convicted
murderer.
But the High Court refused to extradite him 3 times, which, you know, that would be fairly standard. It's not a standard practice to convict someone without an investigation. Like, you know, the French authorities have not been able to investigate it. So to convict someone without an investigation it's very unusual. His legacy is, and like, this is not a good man. You know, he was admittedly abusive towards his partner Jules, who he was with for the latter half of his life. So just he's not someone who I think, you know, is popular in the West Cork area.
No,
I think people got really sick. I think he would come into pubs and read his poetry and people just were having none of him.
Well, I think people were just like, I think the main thing was, why are you here? Still here? Like, if you were part of a community and you were had this involvement, would you not like go away, or would you not maybe not do interviews all the time or put yourself in the public eye as much as you possibly can? Like, I think it was all that stuff that really didn't sit well with people.
That's because the sense always was that he truly enjoyed the attention.
Yeah. Which, and I think that's what people didn't like. And the thing is, I can hear an argument that, you know, for someone being like, well, if he was innocent and he had nothing to do with it, then surely he has a right to live his life as he would want. And I can hear that argument. But it's, look, the whole thing is uncomfortable. And at the end of the day, the only reason that we know Ian Bailey's name is because Sophie Toscan du Plantier was murdered. And that is a tragedy. And the fact that we still don't know for fact what happened to her is awful, and I'm sure it continues to be a massive heartbreak for her family. I don't know, will they get any peace from this or if they have any feelings about this, but one way or the other, Ian Bailey is no longer with us.
I think the one hope, the one kind of shred of optimism, is that, like, maybe now that he's passed, it becomes easier for people to speak about things he may have said, things he may have done. You don't have to worry about sort of litigation. So maybe there will be some new information to come out. That's kind of the, I suppose, the best case scenario.
Okay, well, Carl, we have talked for half an hour.
Wow.
Yeah, I don't know how that happened. It keeps happening. I have an idea. We might be making a change to give ourselves a little bit of breathing room. That's me just dropping a bit of foreshadowing. I really appreciate your time, Carl. And people can obviously read, you can read Carl's brilliant column, Surrealing in the Years, every Saturday on thejournal.ie. And also he writes other brilliant bits for thejournal.ie as well. And as always, I'm going to give you a chance to flag your social media so you can grow that following.
Yeah, you can follow me on Twitter at TV's Carl Kinsella or on Instagram at Carl.Kinsella. You can also follow me on like Blue Sky, but I wouldn't bother. There's not much going on over there.
Oh, it is. And Threads just didn't go the way I wanted it to go. It's just not Twitter.
No.
But X isn't Twitter anymore either. It's so tragic. Anyway, look, that's for another day. Carl, have a great one. I have been a hard and fast admirer of Philly McMahon, and this is Pop Baby B for years now. I think the first thing that I interacted with in terms of their work was Alice in Wonderland, starring Sarah Green, who you may know from Bad Sister, brilliant Apple series, obviously by Sharon Horgan. She starred in a kind of alt version of Alice in Wonderland set in Dublin, and it was so brilliant. It absolutely blew my mind. It made me completely rethink what theatre is and what theatre can be. And then since then, I don't think that This Is Pop Baby have done much that I haven't gone to see or interacted with in some way. They are back with Wake, which is a show that first was in the Dublin Fringe Festival a couple of years ago. It is so fantastic. I won't go on about it too much because I go on about it a fair amount in the interview. But I think you will love it. And it was great to talk to Philly, who is, of course, co-director of This Is Pop Baby, about that show and what you can expect. But I also had to quiz him about Eurovision, because Philly was supposed to be creative directing the Irish entry in 2020, but then obviously because of the dreaded COVID virus and the global pandemic and the total shutdown, Eurovision didn't happen that year. So he did not get to do it, but he has lots of experience and lots of thoughts. And with the caveat, of course, that I do believe that Eurovision should be taking steps in terms of Israel's involvement in Eurovision this year. But in the interim, I will talk about it until we know for sure that that's not going to happen. I will still talk about it. And I still think it's worth talking about the brilliant people who are entering themselves up for Eurosong for Ireland this year. If you're listening on Friday, it's happening tonight on the Late Late Show. And just generally about our approach to Eurovision as a nation. I hope you enjoy. This is Philly McMahon. Well, Philly McMahon, it is a pleasure to speak to you. You are currently a Paris, in Paris, which I was just saying I'm so jealous of. Have you been having a fruitful time there?
Stunning time in Paris, and the Irish Cultural Centre here is just an amazing place. And actually, if anybody's listening, any artists are listening, the applications for residencies, the portal is open right now. So if you go on to Le Centre Culturel Irlandais, you can apply for a residency here in Paris, which is just an absolute treat.
Yeah, and from what I hear, like, I've never been on any kind of artist residency because I don't think I qualify, but I always think it sounds amazing because you don't know who you're going to be there with. And it always sounds like there's this incredible mix of, like, you might be inspired by people that you meet, you could be inspired just by the environment, you could be inspired just by having time away from home. But it seems to be like a very kind of almost a situation with alchemy in it.
It's all of the above. And like, when do you ever get like somebody to go like, yoink, have a month out of your regular life? Here's a room, here's a flight to Paris, you know, soak up the city. So it's a, you know, it's kind of magic. And it's great to be out of Dublin in January.
Yes, 100%. No doubt about that. But look, I'm all about forward plans right now because it is hard enough this January without things to look forward to. And I know one of the things that I'm really looking forward to is the return of Wake, which is, of course, your show. This Is Pop Baby show. And it blew people's minds when it was on in the National Stadium as part of Dublin. It was Dublin Fringe, wasn't it?
Dublin Fringe in the year before last, so 2022.
I can't do time. I was like, that could have been 6 years ago or it could have been last year. Like, I couldn't figure it out. But it was spectacular and it was all anybody was talking about. So I know that there's much celebration about the fact that it's coming back. But for people who don't know what Wake is all about, give them the big sell.
We make these large scale, kind of homegrown, kind of massive shows. And they're kind of, they take our own traditions. For us, it's like, you know, to look at our own traditions and go like, how do we who make these kind of pop culture moments, how do we take ownership of our own traditions, kind of remix them, throw glitter on them, and kind of serve them back as these kind of big, almost concert experiences. That's what I think. Like, for me, the impulse is like when I walk into the Beyonce concert, like that rush of adrenaline, like I want that when I go into the theater. Do I always get it? No. but I want to give that, right? So, and for us, we make these large scale theatrical, I'm going to say variety shows, because like you're kind of plucking these experts from their field. So for instance, we have like this kind of incredible, gorgeous, world-class Irish tap dancer. We also have Felicia Alessania, who's an incredible spoken word artist. We've got Lizette Kroll, who's a champion, world champion pole dancer. There's choreography, there's a live band, there's trad instruments. It's like, there's a lot of WTF to this. but I think one of the reviews said, and it really chimed with me, one of the reviews said, it's like Riverdance for club queens. And I thought, oh yeah, you've stuck the pin in it there. And so we're at Dublin's National Stadium, the boxing arena on South Circular Road. And so there's just a sense of, and for anybody that's thinking like, oh, what has Dublin got to offer at the moment? You know, because we're always asking those things and like, you know, rent. And it's just like, bam, we're making stuff homegrown. We're doing it in a neighborhood. Dublin 8 is absolutely kicking. And it's one of those ones, particularly if you are looking for some sort of cool credits on like a date, bring them along to Wake, because it's actually like, so it's a big show. It's a big show.
There's a couple of things there that rang true with me. I think that description is so true, that like Riverdance for Club Queens description, because it is so fun. It's so contemporary. It's so cool. And I feel like it's almost like, you know, the kind of excitement that you used to get when you were a kid and you were taken to like a kid's show. It's like that, but for grown-ups, because there will always be moments that make you really think and that make you really feel. But then there's also always kind of the ridiculous as well, which is how most of us actually live our lives. And it makes sense that that would all be encapsulated in one show, I think. And I think you guys do that so well.
Yeah, like silliness is to be celebrated, right? And like, when do we, you know, we talk about getting out and letting our hair down, but like this show actually gives you license to do that. And there's something happened on the first preview. You never know with these shows, like are people gonna like it, what's gonna happen, but something happened on the first preview of this show, in the first third of a show, which is kind of tricky because people are kind of warming up, you know, they've left the babies there, all of these kind of things, where everybody stood up together, the entire audience just jumped to their feet and raving, like it's to a kind of a 90s rave track. And you kind of thought, oh, we're on to something here. We're kind of, and it was kind of post-pandemic, and there's, it's just to say that Wake is the spine of the show is the Irish Wake, which is, you know, you have to be invited to a wedding, but anybody can go to a wake, right? And so it is the best party in our culture, and it's not about death. It's about transformation. It's about that kind of the counter and the altar, right? So it's about like moving through a phase of your life. And there's something about nightclubs. You go into the nightclub at 11, you know, 11 p.m. You come out at 3 o'clock sweating. And there's just something about the catharsis, about banging your feet, about being together, that this show tries to honor. So so the Wake is the thing. And there's something about like this show is in what we call in the round, which is the stage is in the middle of the floor and the audience are all around them, right? Something about not only looking at performers, but looking across at other audience members, ergo other citizens, you know, your community. And you kind of just think like, this is the space where the phones are down, the internet is off, and we're kind of celebrating our culture. And we're celebrating like, we're, you know, we talk about the New Ireland. We're celebrating like our own traditions, remixed, updated, silliness, camp, fun, are all in the mix in there.
Yeah, I think you're so right. And I think that thing of like looking at each other, I find these days it can be harder and harder to be, find yourself in a situation where you're like, oh, these are my people. And particularly, I think right now, when everything feels kind of grim and divided because of what's going on politically in the world, and obviously lots of people are struggling financially, and there are so many struggles, and there's so much kind of toxicity around if you are online a lot, and if you're looking at some of the stuff that's happening around our country and internationally. But when you get into a space and you look around and you go, oh, these are my people, we are like-minded, there actually are loads of us. It can be kind of heartening in a very magical way. And I think this show really achieves that.
Thank you. Yeah. I always think about like, I kind of bang on about like nightclubs being a place where not only did we like socialize, but we built value systems.
Yeah.
Right. And like, I'm getting on a bit now, Louise, right? But like in terms of like when we were younger and the Pod nightclub, it was kind of like, you met people from all over the city. Ideas were not discussed verbally, but they were kind of felt. And there was kind of a sense in the nightclub, like you don't get to stay on the dance floor if you're an asshole, right? And so I kind of tried to bring all of that into the theater, and just that kind of like the theater for me, this is boring. I'm sorry, everybody's listening, but the theater for me is kind of a town hall, right? It's somewhere where we can come and we can discuss ideas and we can really kind of hash it out together. And there's something about the town crier, the performer going like, hear ye, like this. And then we throw glitter on it, and then we put a dance beat behind it, And then we kind of do all of this kind of group choreography. And then like, so it's a way for, I think, for us to kind of exercise something and fundamentally entertain. And so, you know, so it's hugely exciting for us to do, but it's also rewarding. One of the nicest, you know, you catch moments. And you catch moments when you're making a show, like you'll be queuing for the toilet and you'll hear other people talking about the show, right? Mm-hmm. And they don't always like them, let's be real. Mm-hmm. but with this show, with Wake, the nicest thing to eavesdrop on was the bus stop across the road on South Circular Road. Mm-hmm. The show spills out and suddenly there's 100 people at this bus stop and they are just fizzing and you know, and then suddenly the bus is crammed with all of these people off the show. And like, you kind of think, that's so nice. There's just a sense of, you know, people have taken the message of the show, which is about, which is really about coming together and building, rebuilding community, right? Mm-hmm. But they've taken all of that and they've taken it into town and the tendrils of it have spilled out into the city. Mm-hmm. And so all of that is, you know, is very satisfying. So it's kind of, it's a joy, this one. It's a joy. And also it's a, you know, we're playing to 900 people a night. It's a big one.
Yeah. But it's brilliant. And I saw it in the first round. I'm definitely going to go back and see it again. I can't recommend it enough. And as Philly said, like, it's one you could take a date to. It's one you could go to with a group of pals. It's one you could go to with anyone. I think anyone would enjoy it. Your mom, your dad, like, you know, really any grown up. It is a show for grown ups, really, isn't it? Am I right in saying that? Or would you bring your kids?
I think have brought kids. I think we've kind of said, look, you know, responsible parenting. There are things you may or may not want your child to see. We kind of say 14 plus, but it's not like, it's not a, you know, it's not a panto. It's not the kind of thing that like, it's a kid's night out. Like, it's an adult night out. But yeah, like the mammies love it. The aunties love it. You know, bring a date, bring your gals, like whatever. It's kind of, it's a big night out. But it's also like you're particularly like, you know, some of your listeners are going to live in Dublin 7, Dublin 8, Dublin 12, all of that surround. There's something, if you live in any of those areas and you don't have to, something also just amazing about walking to a big show. Like, you know, and having a drink beforehand, having a bite to eat beforehand or a drink afterwards or whatever, like, and then you're home.
Yeah.
Now I should preface all of that and saying that I don't live there, so you know, I'm on that bus. I'm on that bus.
I would also say, like, obviously, there's lots of people who listen who are in other countries, and you know, obviously, I'm not suggesting that you necessarily are going to fly home for this, but if you happen to be around for St. Patrick's Day, it is across two weekends. It's on the weekend of the 9th and 10th, and the 16th and 17th. So if you're someone who lives outside of Dublin in any capacity, you might want to maybe plan a little jaunt. Because I know I often hear from people who are like, why are these things always midweek? I could never go midweek. But there are two weekends. Okay. Like, I think you get the message. You get that I love it. You get that Philly loves it.
Did I say Riverdance for Club Queens?
Yes, that box is ticked. But I have to say, I do mean it sincerely. Like, I genuinely, genuinely love it. And I would never have someone on to recommend something that I didn't truly love on this podcast. But I also wanted to talk to you.
I really appreciate that.
Not at all. But I also wanted to talk to you because of the week that's in it about Eurovision. Because as this podcast comes out, lots of people listen to it on a Friday, which means that Eurosong is coming for Ireland, and a new Eurovision contender is going to be chosen via the Late Late Show tonight, if you're listening on Friday, or has been chosen on Friday night. And obviously, you know, Philly, you're someone who's had strong thoughts and ideas about Eurovision for a long time. And you were supposed to be working on the Eurovision entry for 2020. But then, of course, COVID happened. So you didn't end up getting to fulfill that process. How are you feeling about Eurovision these days?
It's not one that I put on my CV, but like, creative director of the only Eurovision that didn't happen, you know, doesn't really light up people's lives, does it?
Well, we never got to see it come to fruition. It's so heartbreaking. Like, I would have loved to have seen a This Is Pop Baby Eurovision entry from Ireland.
I know. And you know what? It was like, it was a great song. And, you know, you and I have got into trouble about this song before, but about, I can't remember what I said to you on your radio show. But the Eurovision fandom went absolutely ballistic and it came for me. I think I said a bop, as good a bop as Euphoria, which you've got to back your horse, right? If you're, doing Eurovision, you've got to back your horse. Anyway, it's a quote that comes back at me all the time. Anyway.
They don't mess around the Eurovision fans.
They don't, the Eurovision fans. And you know what? They're getting more passionate and they are growing in numbers. And that's brilliant. And it's actually something that RT should really, you know,
make use of.
I think they make use of. And I think they are like, look, think of your song, or, you know, if you're listening on Friday, it's tonight. Like, they are listening. Like, this is probably like the strongest Euro song we've had in, you know, in memory. Like, I don't love Euro song for loads of reasons, including like the kinds of artists that you might want to throw their hat in the ring are not going to go onto the Late Late Show and perform in a kind of competitive environment. But the Eurovision is a competitive atmosphere. But I think for me, I'm jumping straight into it now. You haven't even asked me a question.
I'm ready. Keep bring it.
We're in it. For me, it's less about like the artist or the song per se, because I think like this is a really strong Euro song. And I think like, you know, it has been curated. And I think like, let's appreciate that. Mm. And let's appreciate that like styles and genres of music are kind of acknowledged in there. But
yeah, it's a very diverse group of songs, which I think is great.
Yes, and it says to people who are working in those genres, you know, oh, I could stick my song in because it can live there or whatever. Yeah. I just think of Eurovision like as a theatrical production. I always have. Mm. And I think that the song is one element of it. And I know that like, yeah, but it's the Eurovision Song Contest. And it's like, yeah, but it's not really, is it? Because somebody comes out and does the dance break and then everyone starts pressing the voting button, right? And so like, I think that I'm really interested to see what happens in Eurosong. I think there are stronger options in there, but I think like, I also acknowledge that like my own tastes and opinions, you know, are blown out of the water when I listen to some of the Eurovision fans who like have a real sense of how the competition works. Where's your money for tonight's competition, Louise?
So I think that Erica's going to win. I love Erica. I think Erica's super, super popular and loads of people love her and they know her, and people tend, I think, to vote for people that they know and love already. I think that if I was going to go for like a wild card, and in fairness, one of my podcast listeners who is on the Patreon actually sent me a lengthy voice note making a case for this person. And I since then have spent some time with them and I'm like, yeah, I could see that is Bambi Thug with her I think they're non-binary with their Doomsday Blue song. Because I think you're right. I think what you said there about it being a theatrical performance and how it's nice to think that it's about the song, but the reality is the vast majority of voters are only hearing the song for the first time as they're watching the performance. And it's actually what they remember and what has the most impact on them. And that is not just the song. That's the entire performance and the show and the production. And so I think if Ireland came out with something like that is so unexpected for Ireland, people would remember it and people would take note.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that for me, Bambi Thug is the one that I will listen to on Spotify. Mm. I always think like people try to kind of get the message of Eurovision across through their song in some way. So for instance, like Wild Youth, We Are One, right? Mm. Which felt cynical last year to the kind of, you know, to the audience, to the voters or whatever. Mm. But I do think that Bambi Thug's Doomsday Blues, I wonder about the message of that. I kind of think, you know, united by music, and it's like Doomsday Blues. So I do think that I think it would be beautiful if they represented us and then like suddenly Ireland was seen in kind of a different light. I think for Erica the secret sauce is Kieran Connolly. And Kieran Connolly is staging the piece, I believe, and choreographing. And Kieran worked on Ryan O'Shaughnessy's piece in 2018, but he's also worked extensively with the Spice Girls and X Factor and all this. And he is an amazing choreographer and just a brilliant brain. And I think that, like, I know that on Eurosong, they're kind of doing it bigger than they have previously. So I think there's like LED screens and this kind of thing.
Ooh.
And I think they're all, yeah, I think they're all doing staging, which they haven't done before, but which they kind of just show up and sing the song, right? or have a couple of dancers. So it'd be really interesting to see what they all turn out, because, you know, what I really appreciate, particularly this year, is, you know, the online buzz is everybody is going for it.
Oh, yeah. Everybody's
yeah.
100%.
So it's, you know, it's sad in a way, because, like, you know, there's a lot of, they're all artists, they're all like putting, you know, time, probably money,
yeah,
into this kind of competition. So, like, look, fair play to everybody for doing it, you know. And yeah. Who is my money at? Look, I'm probably going to say I think Erica will do it on Friday. The bottom line is what I've always said, because I've been banging on RT's door about this for years. It's about putting on the green jersey. It's not about one artist. It's not about your releasing a single. It's not about what my ambitions are for Eurovision. It's about putting on the green jersey. Whoever can do the job best, let's do it. Let's rally behind them. Let's give them all the support that they need, you know. So fans seem to be excited, and international fans, that's what, like, I think sometimes what people fail to realize is that hordes of, like, millions of international fans, millions, he says, of international fans are watching Eurosong on YouTube afterwards, you know.
Yeah.
So people are paying attention. But I will say this, which is, I do not think we are sending our USP to Eurovision. I don't think, like, when you think, if you go to Dingle for Other Voices or something like that, and you're just blown away by the Irish talent, like, you could lift so many people and just go, put one spotlight on you, sing the song. I don't think that we are sending our USP, and I don't think that we are sending, it's not even, you know, we've got six great pop artists in this competition, but like, just that kind of, you know, we're kind of in an Irish revival at the moment. And so kind of trad instruments, like, and I don't mean like, oh, well, here's a fiddle in the middle of it. I just mean like kind of really something that showcases our music scene, our culture, and that only we can do.
Yeah.
And I think that we sometimes go, look, we have to really compete with bells and whistles, and actually I would advocate for just slowing the whole thing down.
Yeah.
Bam, one spotlight, and just showcase an amazing artist and an amazing song. But you know, other people feel differently, and so so you know, I'll be waving my flag in front of the television like everybody else this year.
Yeah, well, me too. Phelan McMahon, thank you so, so much. As I said, Wake is coming to the National Stadium from the 6th to the 23rd of March. Tickets are available now if you go to thisispopbaby.com. I will see you there, Philly, 100%.
WakeTheShow.com.
WakeTheShow.com, sorry. I'm on the wrong website.
There you go.
Classic.
Well, yeah, yeah.
WakeTheShow.com. Okay, thanks so much.
Great chatting to you, Louise.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Why don't more infant formula companies use organic, grass-fed whole milk instead of skim? Why don't more infant formula companies use the latest breast milk science? Why don't more infant formula companies run their own clinical trials? Why don't more infant formula companies use more of the proteins found in breast milk? Why don't more infant formula companies have their own factories instead of outsourcing their manufacturing? We wondered the same thing. So we made ByHeart, a better formula for formula. Learn more at ByHeart.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
It is time to talk about the big showbiz and celebrity stories of the week in the world of entertainment. And we've got interesting things to talk about. We got the Oscar nominations, and boy, did we get Oscar nomination discourse. We also got loads of Paul Mescal this week, and Emer McGlysett, the wonderful Emer McGlysett, was with me to discuss. Emer McGlysett, it is a joy to have you back on the podcast. I was just saying to you that people are always really delighted when you pop up here.
That is very nice to hear.
They love to hear from you.
And I always enjoy the stories.
I love.
And yeah.
Well, we've got lots to talk about today, and we have to, of course, start with the Oscar nominations, but not just the Oscar nominations, the dreaded discourse around the Oscars nominations, which I have to say has become truly toxic.
The great and powerful snub.
It's just the way that people are talking about it, and then the way that people are talking about the way that people are talking about it, and like it's just become this like completely awful thing.
We have, as we always do, lost the run of ourselves.
Fully. But let's start with just the nominations. What has happened here?
Well, the big wigs of the movie world, like the Oppenheimer, most nominations, 11 nominations, Poor Things, Killers of the Flower Moon, and Barbie, the one that's creating the most discourse.
Yeah.
They all, you know, got loads of nominations each. Oppenheimer was the most with 13, and our very own Cillian Murphy got Best Actor nomination. So that's very exciting. I haven't seen it yet. Do you know what it is? It's 3-something hours long.
Yeah.
And that's just a long time to be away from my phone.
Mm.
Now I can still be with my phone during those 3 hours, but I know I'll miss something.
Yes. It's just not for me is how I feel about it. It's just not for me. And that's okay.
Yeah. The length or the movie or both?
Both.
Okay, great. Yeah.
Both.
I recently watched The Snow movie, Society of the Snow, which is the one that's on Netflix now. It's a Spanish-made film.
Oh, it's about the plane crash, right?
The plane crash in the Andes.
Yes.
And I did recently watch that, and because it is in the Spanish language, it's subtitled, and I simply had to put the phone down. Now, I'm going to tell the truth and say that I did pause it 3 times.
Did you?
Just to check in. I do not speak Spanish. You know, I can say an old hola, but dos cervezas, por favor. But yeah, it's the subtitles will really pull you away from the phone.
I have to say, I like that because I am actually genuinely, I have moved into a phase of actual concern about my phone use. Like it's a problem.
Yeah.
Like I really need to not use it so much, but I also don't want to. So, you know, it's tricky territory.
Yeah.
I think I said to Gordon the other day, I was like, I actually think I'm addicted to it, like fully.
Oh yeah.
Like genuinely addicted.
Yeah. I'd be surprised if people aren't nodding along listening going, yes, this is me.
So I find that, yeah, the subtitled programming is good because it does force me to put it down.
Yeah.
I think maybe tonight when I'm watching The Traitors, I'm not watching The Traitors tonight. I'm doing the Your Fat Friend Q&A in the IFI. That's not a plug because it'll be over by the time you listen to this. Maybe tomorrow night when I watch The Traitors, I will put my phone in a different room.
Yeah. How long before you go and get it?
Maybe I won't. I mean, who knows?
Failing you before you've even started.
Anyway, yes.
Anyway, back to the Oscars. Or will we just go straight in and talk about Barbie?
Let's get to it. Yeah.
So when I first heard of the nominations and I looked down the list, and my first thought was, why didn't they nominate Greta Gerwig as best director? Like that, to me, the first thing I was like, that's a snub.
Yeah.
That's weird. Wasn't she nominated?
Yes.
Now, a few years ago, they moved into nominating, I think it's 10 Best Picture, and they still only do 5 Best Directors. And I feel that was a sneaky way to get out of always having to nominate the directors from the Best Picture. Because it was too, like, a few years ago when Argo was nominated for Best Picture and Ben Affleck famously was not nominated as Best Director, and it was like, how is there a best picture without a best director? You know what I mean? So there's been a few times that has happened, but this just felt ridiculous.
It does feel ridiculous. And this is the thing. And obviously we'll get into the Margot Robbie of it all. Every time I say Margot Robbie, I hear Lindsay from Who Weekly saying Margot Robbie.
Yes.
I am so sick of my brain. Still Who Weekly not paying me, by the way, for the many, many, many mentions I give them on this podcast.
Who Weekly coming to Dublin, by the way.
Coming to Dublin. Yeah. Tickets are in the bag. Anyway, Like, we'll get to the Margot Robbie, but the Greta Gerwig, she deserved to be nominated, I think, for Best Director. I think so too. And I've seen so many snarky people on the internet being like, no, what she did was remarkable.
Yeah.
Like, even if you don't think that the writing was that good, she is nominated for adapted screenplay. So, you know, she does have a writing nomination. But visually, that film was amazing. And her hand was in every single aspect.
You could see her. You could see it was a Greta Gerwig film.
It was authored by her.
Yeah.
Like, and it is truly remarkable what they did, the choices that she made in terms of, you know, the sets and the color and the, you know, everything.
Like, one of my favorite scenes in the Barbie. I really enjoyed the Barbie film. It's not my most favorite film of all time, but I really enjoyed it. And the scene where the men sit around the campfire and sing the Matchbox 20 song. Yes. I was like, that is quintessential Greta Gerwig, and it's one of the funniest scenes in the film.
It's so good. But even if you think about the opening sequence where there's the little girl smashing up their baby dolls and then the big giant Barbie is there, like, that's all her. Like, it is truly remarkable, and I think it is insane that Greta Gerwig was not nominated.
I read an interesting thing in Kyle Buchanan wrote in the New York Times, and he pointed out, so everyone who's a member of the Academy gets to vote for Best Picture. So that's almost 600 voters. Mm. Only the people in kind of the director's division mm-hmm. get to vote for Best Director. Mm. And that is 57, mostly men.
Mm.
And they do tend to be on the snobbier side. Mm. And Buchanan in the New York Times is saying, this is why she wasn't nominated, because they might be like, oh yeah, Barbie was enjoyable and it did very well at the box office, but we can't take her seriously as the director of Barbie. We can't pit her against Martin Scorsese.
Which is crazy, because she's now directed 3 films that have been nominated for Best Picture.
The only director ever, I think, or female director, and maybe I'm getting that wrong, to have their first 3 solo features nominated in a row. So she had Lady Bird, then she had Little Women, and now Barbie for Best Picture, sorry.
Yeah.
I think the fuss, like, it, you know, it's been rumbling on for a bit too long now.
Mm.
And there's now lots of memes popping up on social media going, yeah, it's bad what happened to Barbie, but have you seen what's happening in Gaza? And you're like, okay.
Which I have to say, I find frustrating because you can be very concerned about what's happening to Gaza and be talking about what's happening in Gaza and be posting about what's happening in Gaza and also enjoy a little bit of an escapist argument about something that is ultimately not that meaningful to anyone beyond Greta Gerwig. I mean, it obviously has an impact in terms of women in film and stuff, but like, you can have a hold space for both of those things.
I think some of the criticism I've seen is that there are lots of people, maybe particularly women, posting about the Barbie thing who have said nothing about the Gaza thing. And listen, I don't really buy into this whole, like, if you're not talking about Gaza on social media, you don't care.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's just kind of the up in armness of it.
Well, I think Hillary Clinton was the one who particularly got people going, because her social media account posted a kind of meme about Barbie. Greta and Margot, while it can sting to win the box office but not take home the gold, your millions of fans love you. You are both so much more than Knuff. # Hillary Barbie. And then people are like, if you really care about women, then why don't you care about the women in Gaza who are using bits
and
of
also,
tent?
And also, is she
kind
of getting a dig in about how she won the popular vote? Like,
I think she is. It's just,
let's not do this. Anyway, we haven't spoken about Margot Robbie, who is the other snub, and possibly the, like, she was the cent. This is how, so last week the BAFTA nominations came out, and All of Us Strangers, which we have both seen and have been devastated by, got nominations across the board except Andrew Scott in the Best Actor role. And it's like, the film does not exist without Andrew Scott.
No.
And it's kind of the same with Barbie.
And his performance, Andrew Scott's performance, is spectacular.
Yeah. As is Margot Robbie. You're getting it.
Post is being shoved in the door if you hear it in the background.
Difficult delivery there.
I'm appalled that Andrew Scott was not nominated for a BAFTA. And I have to say, I'm really disappointed that All of Us Strangers is not nominated
not
for any
a single
Oscars.
I think maybe the buzz came a little bit too late. Like, it feels very buzzy at the moment. Well, I know they're doing their kind of UK and Ireland press tour at the moment, but
I presume that's why they released it in America in December, was to try and get in on time. Anyway, look, it's a spectacular film. Go see it. You'll hear about it later in my recommendations. But yeah, so Andrew was not nominated for Best Actor at the BAFTAs, despite loads of other nominations. Yeah.
And some of, like, his director, the Andrew Haig, who directed All of Us Strangers, kind of did a social media post and was like, okay, brilliant. I'm so glad to be nominated, but what about Andrew Scott? Mm. And it's kind of similar for Barbie.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. I know, like, five, to nominate five people out of so many thousands of films is difficult.
I think I would have been fine with, to be honest, no acting nominations for Barbie.
Yeah, the fact that Ryan Gosling has been nominated.
Like, don't get me wrong, he's great. Like, yeah. But I think I would have sat easier with no acting nominations for Barbie and a directing nomination for Greta Gerwig than, you know.
Yeah.
And I think I think the reason that people are...
And I'm sorry, America Ferrera has been nominated for Best Supporting Actress for Barbie as well.
And look, America Ferrera is great in that film, but I don't think she deserves that nomination.
And again, reading some of the kind of columns and opinion pieces about it, it's like she delivered like an Oscar performance. And even she said herself...
Did she?
Well, no, that's what kind of, you know... That's what Oscar voters like, that big, you know, strident speech, and people remember it. And even she said herself, I think Variety interviewed her after her nomination, and she was disappointed Margot Robbie wasn't nominated. And she said it's like people don't think the work was hard enough for her, even though that's the hardest work of all, to play Barbie, but also play her as like a real person.
I thought, yeah, like I think if any, so here's, I guess, where I would come down on it. I would have been fine with none of them getting nominations. I think that if anyone in that film should have gotten an acting nomination, it should have been Margot Robbie.
Yeah.
Because she really did personify Barbie.
She did.
Like, she managed to be a real person, but also hold all that Barbie represents.
Yeah.
And I just frankly think that, I do think it comes down to men not getting it.
Yeah, and I think Greta Gerwig, like, I think it's quite shameful that she hasn't been nominated. Thank God there is at least one woman, Justine Triet, who... directed Anatomy of a Fall. She is nominated in the Best Director category.
I'm actually dying to see that film. Yeah, everybody says it's outstanding.
And the other four are all... I was going back just to Poor Things for a second. I saw it during the week. It's great. It's not for everyone.
But I loved it.
It is great. I thought Mark Ruffalo was nominated for Best Supporting Actor. So I was really interested to see his performance in Poor Things. And to me, it's a similar performance to the Ryan Gosling Ken in that he's playing a very funny, very ridiculous character. Yeah. And seeing Mark Ruffalo play that kind of comic role is really fun.
Yeah.
But also I was like, oh, this is interesting that he's been nominated for an Oscar for this, because he's basically kind of taking the piss.
Yeah.
He reminded me of, you know, the kind of the owner of the Moulin Rouge in the film Moulin Rouge. I felt like that's who Mark Ruffalo was playing. This kind of ridiculous, you know, bumbling, sleazy kind of
idiot. But,
interesting, yeah.
Yeah, I really loved Poor Things so much. I'm actually going to see it again tomorrow.
It's great fun, yeah.
I just want to.
I went with a small group of people and there was, you know, dissenting opinions. It wasn't for everyone.
This is why I like going to the cinema on my own.
Yeah.
I don't want anyone else's opinion to interfere with my fresh opinion of a film. It is worth noting as well that Ryan Gosling also said he was disappointed that, that they weren't more recognised. Anyway.
Yeah. Sorry, we do have one more Irish nomination, and it was for Poor Things, obviously, was produced partly by Element Pictures.
Yeah.
We're based in Dublin. And Robbie Ryan is nominated for Best Cinematography for Poor Things. And he is Irish. So we have... him, Killian, and Element Pictures.
Yes, and Robbie Ryan is, like, his work is spectacular.
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah.
Okay, let's move on to the most important thing we have to talk about today, and that is Paul Mescal's publicity tour.
Stunning.
It's been, like...
You would be forgiven for thinking that he is the lead role in All of Us Strangers.
Yeah, well, it's just people are obsessed with him, aren't they?
Yeah, they are.
I thought it's been interesting because, like, obviously we've seen little bits of, like, as I've been obsessing over Andrew Scott and Paul Mescal kind of messing around and stuff. And but this, the UK end, we've seen a lot more Paul Mescal interviews on his own. Mm-hmm. Like, he's done a few bits of radio on his own. But the biggest thing for me was that he did Louis Theroux's podcast on his own. And it was the first time he's ever done like a long podcast interview.
Louis actually pointed that out at the start of the interview. And I was like, God, yeah, he's right. Because like we've never got a proper sit down, full on Paul Mescal interview.
Yeah.
Maybe there's been a couple of print bits that he's done, but never kind of a one on one. And so I've listened to the Louis Theroux interview. It's interesting.
I thought it was interesting
too. There were parts of it where I think Louis Theroux was quite unsettled.
Yeah.
Did you get that at all?
I don't know. Maybe, yeah.
There was no animosity, but I feel like in some ways he had kind of met his match or something.
Wow, that's interesting. That is not my take.
Okay.
So I thought that I kind of came away from it feeling like Paul Mescal is 27.
Yeah.
Like, I really like Paul Mescal. I mean, I don't know him personally, yeah. obviously, but I like what I know of him. And I think he's like a really good and decent person. Mm. He comes across that way. And I think I want him to have every bit of success. But like, you know, there were bits of it where he was kind of talking about things and I was like, God, yeah, you know, when you're younger, you kind of have very strong opinions about yeah. things. And they may be tempered as you get older a little bit. So like when he was talking about Premier League football, for example.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And he was like, I hate it. It's disgusting. Like it's blah, blah, blah. I was like, okay, calm down, Paul Mescal. But
were bits where I was like, oh, he's going to change his mind about that.
Yeah.
You know, but there were other bits where I felt a little bit like, I don't know, there was just something that Louis Theroux was trying to get at and he kept meeting this kind of brick wall or something.
Yeah, and I think like, you know, what they talked about the fact that Paul has very clear ideas of where his boundaries lie in terms of what he's willing to give and what he's not willing to give and the way that he's structuring his life to make sure that he still gets to be a person who can like go to a pub and get drunk, but equally isn't giving away his private life.
Yeah.
And, you know, I found all of that, it's kind of meta to have that conversation in the context of a podcast
and
interview.
And that was really enjoyable.
Which I think, yeah, is really enjoyable.
And he talked
about,
like, he was very open about, like, he said the only Hollywood meeting, the actual meeting he's ever had in Hollywood was for Gladiators.
Yeah.
He's never had another meeting in Hollywood. He's never been in a room.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed those little insights, but there was bits where, like, Louis Theroux kind of tried to make a joke and Paul Mescal was, like, having none of it.
Mm.
Like, a few kind of jabs about money and he was just, like, I'm not going there. I don't know. And then at the end, Louis Theroux kind of did kind of a post, you know, I was going to call it a post-roast reaction.
From the wonderful Emer Nester Sunday Roast.
So Louis Theroux did his post-roast reaction. He was kind of apologizing for various bits where he felt like he'd made a few gaffes.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know if they're 100% the biggest fans of each other.
Oh my God, I feel so differently. I think like at the end, Paul was like, I really enjoyed it. And I think he really did.
I think he did enjoy it. But there was a bit at the start where there was some chat about Paul Mescal sorting out tickets for Louis Theroux for Streetcar Named Desire.
Well, this
and
is
then
because
he didn't show up. Or
well, what happened was they met on the red carpet at the GQ Awards. And then Louis Theroux was on a radio show. And I think it was something about like, you know, their interaction, or maybe it was like, who's the most famous person you have on your phone or something. And he was like, well, I did have Paul Mescal's number and he gave it to me at the GQ Awards because I wanted to go see him in Streetcar Named Desire. But then I tried to contact him and his number's dead. And he was kind of joking, like, and implying that he changed his number to avoid Louis Theroux.
Right.
So that's what they were talking about.
Okay. Maybe I don't know. I just felt I think they both really enjoyed it. But I got a weird sense of tension.
Interesting.
And at the very end, they obviously were on a very short time frame because at the very end, Louis's like, we only have 2 minutes left. And there was obviously someone hovering outside the door, like a PR person. And he asks Paul Mescal, are you happy? And Paul kind of falters a bit and he goes, I'm fine. And Louis Theroux kind of is frustrated. He's like, oh, we're only getting to this now. And it's like, if you'd gotten to that earlier, I don't know how much further down that road he would have gone.
You know, this is like, without getting too kind of, you know, boots on the ground about it or nuts and bolts about it. Like, this is the challenge as an interviewer.
Mm.
And I think that people kind of from the outside, if it's not something that you do, understandably, you probably won't understand, is that when you go in and you've got a defined space of time with someone, and sometimes you might only have 10 minutes, you have to use that time very carefully because a huge portion of the job is warming the person up and getting them to feel like they are willing to open up with you or give you anything, you know? And so you have to be so careful about how you use your time because you could need most of your time to warm them up to even get to any good stuff. And then sometimes people are like, why didn't they ask the hard questions? And it's like, well, if you go in cold and you ask a hard question, the person's just going to be like, fuck you.
Yeah.
Why am I going to answer this hard question? Yeah. Like, I don't know you. Whereas if you can get them kind of on your side, that's why the most skillful people at those press junkets where you only get 10 minutes are people who are immediately
get people to like them.
Whatever reason.
Yeah, I it was... It was I found it very interesting, yeah, probably the most insightful stuff we've heard from Paul Mescal. Mm. Do I feel a bit protective over him?
Like, I thought it was interesting. Like, I sent you an article from The Mirror, and the headline is Paul Mescal reveals how much he got paid to star in the Denny's sausages ad, which I thought was so funny.
Yeah.
What a hilarious news line to take from a podcast
so
interview.
So good. So he only got paid €5,000.
Sure, I'm not surprised by that.
Yeah, I suppose now that we know who he is, and actually there was a few bits during the interview that were Louis through was kind of like, oh, you were paid at least 10 million for Gladiator. And I mean, he just probably doesn't know how much he was paid. But Paul Mescal's reaction was like, it sounds like he was paid at least that. But being paid 5,000. And he said then that he used it to pay his rent for the rest of the year. And he was worried he was never going to make enough money acting, because he was like, if this is how much I'm going to earn for doing an ad, then, you know, maybe I shouldn't have given up the sport.
Yeah.
So.
I want to listen to it again now, because having heard your perspective, I'm sure you'll all go and listen to it now, those of you who are listening to this.
And I love Louis. It's not like I love
Louis too. Yeah. No, I kind of see what you mean. It's hard. Yeah, it's a hard thing to do.
Do you know what it was? I think I was kind of surprised at Louis's frustration that he hadn't kind of broken him in the time that he'd been given, and the fact that we were able to hear that in him.
Yeah.
And I felt there were a few times during the interview where he was trying to almost break him.
Mm.
And it was like, you don't have to do that, whatever. Like, I don't particularly want to hear Paul Mescal crying about something sad that's going on in his life, you know?
I think he probably felt like, because no one else has gotten this opportunity, he probably felt like he needed to make the most of it.
Yeah.
And maybe he just didn't do what he thought he wanted to do, which upon reflection, what he did was perfect.
Yeah, it was great.
Okay, we've got a few quick other stories to touch on before we finish, because we've been talking for a very long time. Justin Timberlake is coming back, but the question is, does anybody want him?
No.
I don't think that people do.
No, I don't. I think it's too soon. It's too soon. He has a new song actually coming out today, but we're recording too early for us to hear it.
Mm.
God forgive me, I've heard 30 seconds of it and I was like, that sounds great.
Oh, really? I haven't heard it yet.
I don't know. Like, I think, like, I'm not a Justin Timberlake fan, but I think Mirrors is one of the greatest pop songs ever written. And I feel like, is this kind of in that vein?
Yeah.
He's going to be on SNL. So the song is called Selfish, and his new album is called Everything I Thought I Was. And you're just going to look at those words and think about him in the context of Britney.
Well, exactly. It's because of the Britney book. Everybody's like, this guy's a dickhead. And, you know, in fairness, there'll be people who've always thought that. My question is, when he's hosting Saturday Night Live, is he going to acknowledge that? Is he going to acknowledge the Britney of it all?
Not this Saturday, but next Saturday, the 3rd of February, I think it is. He is the musical guest. Dakota Johnson is
hosting. He's the musical guest.
Yes.
Oh.
But he has a long history of being very, very, very good on SNL.
Yeah.
He has great comedy chops. He was in Lonely Island with Andy Samberg. So I don't know. I suspect they won't touch the Britney stuff.
Yeah.
Or maybe it might be mentioned, but he won't, you know,
be in the
scene or whatever.
That's interesting. We'll have to watch and see anyway.
Yeah.
I know we're kind of sick of talking about Barry Keoghan and Saltburn and the bath, right? But I did feel that when I came across this piece of information, I just felt like we had to share it with the people.
There's great quotes from the film's production designer, Susie Davis. And of course, she's talking about the bathtub scene. And there was just a few. Can I just read her words?
Please do.
So she says, to create the gooey liquid with the correct consistency, viewers eventually saw, Davy said the crew used yogurt and a bit of milk and some water. Here it comes. She added that Keoghan took 4 takes of the shot, saying he did it 4 times and really went for it. Everyone he did was a different kind of slurp. Everyone he did was a different kind of slurp.
And I like all of these individual ingredients, but I feel like yogurt and a bit of milk and some water sounds so much more disgusting than what it was actually meant to be.
I know. You'd rather just...
Honestly, do the real thing.
Go for the brine.
It's so disgusting.
Yeah. Some 4 different types of slurp.
And then we don't have time to really get into this, but...
Oh, this is Ted Mosby from How I Met Your Mother's Wedding. Well, I've actually made a list of the craziest things from his wedding.
Please.
Which we could fly through quite quickly.
So for context, Josh Radnor, actor who played Ted whoever in How I Met Your Mother, that's not a program I ever watched.
He's the main guy. It's him who's meeting the mother.
Okay.
Yeah.
So he was getting married.
Yeah.
But there was a snowstorm.
There was a snowstorm. So he met his wife while on mushrooms at a retreat, mm-hmm. and they heard voices telling them to be together. As you do.
Of course.
As you do. So their wedding was in January, upstate New York, outside, -6.7 degrees Celsius. I converted it. The vows went on for 20 minutes in this -6.7 degrees.
It is, like, it is not just snowing. It's a blizzard.
It's a blizzard.
Like, the photos, there's a New York Times article about it, and the photos are hilarious,
yeah.
because everyone
they're
is
borderline
sitting,
shady. Like, they're all photos of people like desperately trying to warm their hands, and people with umbrellas looking miserable.
But there's a photo of all the people who are at the ceremony under umbrellas, just sitting wrapped up in like their warmest clothes,
and
like,
then they
shivering.
Did 20 minutes of
20
vows.
Minutes. Oh,
there was another little bit of shade in the article I enjoyed. She had never seen How I Met Your Mother because she's a TV buff.
So people ended up getting stranded
people
at this wedding.
People ended up getting stranded.
Including the person who wrote this New York Times piece.
Yes.
Which people are saying is probably
the
why
band,
it's shady.
The band, the photographer, the New York Times journalist, all the guests who weren't planning on staying on this kind of upstate estate in New York ended up having to stay. And most of the wedding was overshadowed by people frantically checking the weather app. And then when finally everyone was like, you're just going to have to stay, then they were allowed to... have a good time.
Because the issue was that they knew that this snowstorm was coming and they insisted on carrying on with the wedding.
Oh, it was part of, they wanted people to be able to feel their authentic selves. All of their guests. Somebody said, Pamela Fryman, who directed How I Met Your Mother, said, when they renew their vows, maybe they can do it in the spring. Everyone was annoyed.
I highly recommend... If you like chaos weddings, check out this New York Times article. I'll put it in the link.
There was also a slightly shady reference to the fact that he's now a songwriter, and at one stage it was just him and his guitar around the fire.
Oh my god!
While everyone else listened.
It sounds like hell.
Now Wonderwall.
Okay, I will, as I said, link this in the show notes. It is spectacular. Eimear McGlaisa, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Oh, by the way, where can people find you?
I'm on Instagram at Eimear the Screamer. I'm not really on Twitter anymore, so there's not much point in talking about that.
You can read Eimear's column on Fridays in the Irish Times.
Thank you.
And of course, she is the co-author of the Oh My God, What a Complete Aisling books. And the audiobook of the final Oh My God, What a Complete Aisling book is out now. If you were looking for that, it is now available. And also, of course, Eimear co-presents Eimear Nestor's Sunday Roast with Eimear Nestor.
Where would I be without you?
She is not good at self-promotion, but I love to promote her.
I'm like, I'm not on Twitter anymore.
Well, my friends, it is just about time for me to go. But before I do, can I just say thank you very much for tuning in. It means so much to me. I appreciate so much that you listen every week. If it is your first time, thank you for sticking through the whole episode. I usually do recommendations at this stage of the podcast, but I don't have a load of recommendations this week, aside from really All of Us Strangers, as discussed at the start of the podcast. It is a beautiful, beautiful film. It is a great time to go to the cinema at the moment. And I am loving this movie era for us. Aside from that, if you want more episodes, and as I said at the start, to support the podcast, I would be so grateful if you joined us on the Patreon. It's patreon.com/catchupwithlouisemacsharry. If you think you might buy me a coffee if you saw me out and about, this is a good alternative, and I will love you forever. That is a promise, a commitment from me to you. Aside from that, thank you so much to my contributors. Thank you so much to Acast. I hope you have a lovely week, but if you don't, that's okay too. They can't all be good weeks. Let's just put one foot in front of the other, and together we'll be again next Friday.
Why don't more infant formula companies use organic, grass-fed whole milk instead of skim? Why don't more infant formula companies use the latest breast milk science? Why don't more infant formula companies run their own clinical trials? Why don't more infant formula companies use more of the proteins found in breast milk? Why don't more infant formula companies have their own factories instead of outsourcing their manufacturing? We wondered the same thing. So we made ByHeart, a better formula for formula. Learn more at ByHeart.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.